I've been thinking about something. It seems to me we have reached a real barrier to finding Rossi.
I nodded glumly.
There is another resource we can try. You were right when you asked me about my mother while we were still in the United States. I have been thinking about her all day. She knew Professor Rossi long before you did, and I never truly asked her about him.
Hope had leapt up in me with her first words. But how can we talk with her? I thought you said she had no phone.
We will have to go see her in person. She lives in a small town outside Budapest.
What? Now it was my turn to be irritable. Oh, very simple. We just hop a train with your Hungarian passport and my, oops, American passport, and drop by to chat with one of your relatives about Dracula. Unexpectedly, Helen smiled.
There is no reason to be so bad-tempered, Paul. We have a proverb in Hungarian. If a thing is impossible, it can be done.
I had to laugh. All right. What's your plan? I've noticed you always have one. She smoothed out her gloves.
Yes, I have. Actually, I am hoping my aunt will have a plan.
Your aunt?
My aunt has worked in the Hungarian Ministry of the Interior since 1948, and she is a rather important lady. I got my scholarships because of her. She is my mother's older sister, and she helped my mother flee from Romania to Hungary. We are very close, my aunt and I, and she will do whatever I ask her. Unlike my mother, she has a telephone, and I think I will call her.
You mean she could bring your mother to the phone somehow to talk with us?
Oh, Lord. Do you think that we can talk with them on the phone about anything private or controversial?
I'm sorry.
No, we will go there in person. My aunt will arrange it.
Well, I'm willing to try almost anything for Rossi, although it's hard for me to imagine just waltzing into communist Hungary.
Ah, then it will be even harder for you to imagine waltzing, as you say, into communist Romania.
Helen sat on a chair in the parlor and dialed through a maze of numbers. At last I saw her face brighten. She smiled at me, her beautiful, frank smile.
It's ringing. My aunt is going to hate this.
Then her face changed again, to alertness.
Eva? Elena?
Then Helen seemed to forget my presence, but she eventually raised her glance to me again and gave a wry little smile and a triumphant nod, as if the outcome of her conversation was favorable. She smiled into the receiver and hung up. Immediately our concierge was upon us, apparently worried about her phone bill, and I quickly counted out the agreed-upon amount. Helen was already on her way back to her room, beckoning me to follow. I thought her secrecy unnecessary, but what did I know, after all? I groaned, settling into the armchair again. "Quick, Helen, the suspense is killing me."
It's good news. I knew my aunt would try to help in the end. I'm supposed to call her again tomorrow night. She's very clever, my aunt, so I have no doubt she will find a way. We will get some round-trip tickets to Budapest from Istanbul, maybe the airplane when we hear more.
I sighed inwardly, thinking of the probable expense, and wondering how long my funds would hold out in this chase. It seems to me she'll have to be a miracle worker to get me into Hungary and keep us out of trouble along the way. Helen laughed.
She is a miracle worker. That is why I am not at home working in the cultural center in my mother's village.
We went downstairs again, and as if by mutual consent drifted out to the street. Although I was half loath to break the quiet between us. Helen, do you think he could have been buried here in Istanbul? That would explain Sultan Mehmed's anxiety about him after his death, wouldn't it?
He? Ah, yes. That is an interesting idea. But wouldn't Mehmed have known about it? And wouldn't Turgut have found some evidence of it? I cannot believe such a thing could have been hidden here for centuries.
Helen, if there's some chance that the tomb is here, it could mean Rossi is here too. She turned and looked into my face.
But of course, Paul.
We've got to check with Turgut, or someone who knows the geography of the city, and compare some maps of the city with the dragon. I read in the guidebook that Istanbul has underground ruins, too. Catacombs, cisterns, that kind of thing, like Rome. We have at least a day before we leave. Maybe we could talk with Turgut about it. Because we were reading so closely the thoughts written on each other's faces, I failed at first to look hard at the figure that seemed suddenly to be looking hard at me. Besides, it was no tall and menacing specter, but rather a small, slight man, ordinary among those crowds, hovering about 20 feet away against the wall of a church. Then, in an instant of shock, I recognized the little scholar with the shaggy gray beard, crocheted white cap, and drab shirt and pants who had come into the archive that morning. But the next second brought a much greater shock. The man had made the mistake of gazing at me so intently that I could suddenly see him face on through the crowd. Then he was gone, disappearing like a spirit among the cheerful tourists. I dashed forward, almost knocking Helen over, but it was no use. The man had vanished. He had seen me see him. His face, between the awkward beard and new cap, had been indisputably a face from my university at home. I'd last looked at it just before it was covered by a sheet. It was the face of the dead librarian. If seeing the dead librarian once again had not been enough to keep me wide-eyed that night while the hours passed more and more quietly, there was the sleeping face not far from my own, but not so close, either. I had insisted that Helen sleep in my bed while I sat up in the shabby armchair. When my eyelids drooped once or twice, a glance at that strong, grave face sent a wave of anxiety through me, bracing as cold water. Helen had wanted to stay in her own room. What, after all, would the concierge think if she found out about this arrangement? But I had pressed her until she agreed, if irritably, to rest under my watchful eye. I could not bring myself to read or write. Certainly I had no desire to open my briefcase, which in any case I had pushed under the bed where Helen slept. But the hours wore on, and there was no mysterious scratching in the corridor, no snuffling through the keyhole, no smoke pouring silently in under the door, no beating of wings at the window. Finally, a little grayness pervaded the dim room, and Helen sighed as if sensing the coming day. Then a handspan of sunlight made its way through the shutters, and she stirred. I took my jacket, slid the briefcase out from under the bed as quietly as I could, and went tactfully away to wait for her in the entrance downstairs. It was not yet 6 o'clock, but a smell of strong coffee came from somewhere in the house, and to my surprise I found Turgut sitting on one of the embroidered chairs, a black portfolio across his lap. He looked amazingly fresh and wide awake, and when I entered he jumped up to shake my hand.
"Good morning, my friend. Thank the gods I have found you immediately."
"I'm thankful to them, too, that you're here." I sunk into a chair near him. "But what on earth brings you so early?"
"I could not stay away when I have news for you."
"I have news for you, too. You go first, Dr. Bora."
"Last night, I called my friend Selim Aksoy. He is not at the university, he is a shopkeeper, but he is a very learned man. I asked him to seek for me any trace of burial of someone from Wallachia here in Istanbul in the late 15th century, or any clue that there might be a tomb here somehow connected with Wallachia, Transylvania, or the Order of the Dragon. We worked late into the night. At last we found a strange thing, a letter reprinted in a volume of correspondence between the ministers of the Sultan's court and many outposts of the empire in the 15th and 16th centuries. I have translated it for you here."
Turgut pulled a sheet of notebook paper from his portfolio.
"The earlier letter to which this letter refers is not in the book, alas. To the most honored Rumeli Kadiaska, that was the chief military judge for the Balkans, you know."
I didn't know, but he nodded and went on.
"Honored one, I have now carried out the further investigation you requested. Some of the monks have been most cooperative for the sum we agreed upon, and I have examined the grave myself. What they reported to me originally is true. They have no further explanation to offer me, only repetitions of their terror. I recommend a new investigation in this matter in Istanbul. I have left 2 guards in Snagov to watch for any suspicious activity. Curiously, there have been no reports of the plague here. I remain yours in the name of Allah."
My heart was beating hard. Even after my sleepless night, I was wide awake. "And there are no other letters in the book that refer to this matter?"
"None. No previous letters, no subsequent letters. It is a fragment. We searched long and hard after this and found nothing relating to it. He told me he has never seen this word Snagov in any other accounts of the history of Istanbul that he can remember.
My God.
Yes.
Turgut smiled as cheerfully as if we'd been discussing a menu for breakfast.
The public inspectors for the Balkans were very worried about something here in Istanbul. So worried that they sent someone to the grave of Dracula in Snagov.
But God damn it, what did they find? I pounded my fist on the arm of my chair. What had the priests there reported? And why were they terrified?
Exactly my perplexity. If Vlad Dracula was resting peacefully there, why were they worried about him hundreds of kilometers away in Istanbul? And if Vlad's tomb is indeed in Snagov, and always was, why do the maps not match that region?
I could only respect the precision of his questions. There is another thing. Do you think there is indeed the possibility that Dracula was buried here in Istanbul? Would that explain Mehmet's worry about him after his death and the presence of vampirism here from that era on?
Clearly we must search more, further. Selim says he will lead us to the archive as soon as you can be ready. Selim, he never sleeps, you know, went for his morning coffee because he did not wish to surprise you right away. Ah, here he is.
The bell at the pension door rang and a slender man stepped in, pulling the door shut behind him. I think I had expected an august presence, an aging man in a business suit, but Selim Aksoy was young and slight, dressed in loose-fitting and rather shabby dark trousers and white shirt. Turgut introduced us.
Are you ready to go?
Mr. Aksoy waved aside Turgut's offer of a seat in the parlor. Not quite. If you don't mind, I will see how Miss Rossi is and when she can join us. I ran into Helen on the stairs, literally, for I suddenly found myself taking the steps three at a time. She grabbed the railing to keep herself from toppling down the staircase.
Ouch! What in the name of heaven are you doing?
She was rubbing her elbow, and I was trying not to keep feeling the brush of her black suit and firm shoulder against my arm. Looking for you. I'm sorry. Are you hurt? I just got a little worried because I'd left you alone up there so long.
I'm fine. I've had some ideas. Have you called Professor Bora?
He's here already, and he brought a friend. I was hoping to keep Turgut back as we talked, so that I could tell him privately about the appearance of the vicious librarian from home. Turgut was deep in conversation with Helen before we'd walked a block, however. We found the outer door to the library unlocked and went quietly in, Turgut ushering Helen gallantly before him. The little entrance hall with its fine mosaics and the registration book lying open and ready for the day's visitors was deserted. Turgut held the inner door for Helen, and she had gone well into the hushed, dim hall of the library before I heard her intake of breath, and saw her stop so suddenly that our friend almost tripped behind her. The librarian waiting for us stood motionless in the middle of the room, his face turned, as if eagerly toward our arrival. He was not, however, the friendly figure we'd expected. His face was pale, as if drained of life. Exactly as if drained of life. This was not Turgut's librarian friend, but ours, alert and bright-eyed, his lips unnaturally red, and his hungry gaze burning in our direction. Before I could so much as step between Helen and the ghoulish figure, she pulled a pistol from her jacket pocket and shot him. Later, I knew Helen in a great range of situations, including those we call ordinary life, and she never stopped surprising me. But she never startled me more than at that moment in Istanbul, when she suddenly shot the librarian. I had no time for astonishment, however, because he stumbled sideways and hurled a book toward us. Helen fired again, stepping forward and aiming with a steadiness that took my breath away. The second shot grazed his shoulder. He was already running. He bolted into the stacks at the rear of the hall.
A door! There is a door there!
And we all ran after him, tripping on chairs and darting among the tables. Turgut ran for the door and I ran after, but it was shut tightly. When we got it open, we discovered only an alley, deserted, apart from a pile of wooden boxes. Reluctantly, we returned to the archive through the back door. Helen's gun was nowhere in sight.
Madam, I congratulate you for trying, but it is useless to attempt to kill a dead man.
How did you know?
Oh, I know. I know the look of that face. It is the expression of the undead. There is no other face like that. I have seen it before.
It was a silver bullet. But, as you saw, he moved and I missed his heart.
Have you been carrying around that gun all the time?
Oh, I always carry my pistol when I feel any sort of uneasiness. And it is not so difficult to acquire a silver bullet or two.
Suddenly Tirgut gave a cry and struck his forehead. We all stared.
My friend, Mr. Erozan, I am forgetting him.
It took us only a second to grasp his meaning. Selim Aksoy was the first to hurry into the stacks, and the rest of us scattered quickly around the long room, searching under tables and behind chairs. For a few minutes the hunt was fruitless. Then we heard Selim calling us, and we all rushed to his side. He was kneeling in the stacks at the foot of a high shelf laden with all kinds of boxes, bags, and rolled-up scrolls. The box which housed the papers of the Order of the Dragon lay on the floor beside him, its ornate lid open and some of its contents scattered nearby. Among these relics, Mr. Erozan was stretched out on his back, white and still, his head lolling to one side. Tirgut knelt and put his ear to the man's chest.
Thank God, he is breathing.
Then, examining him more closely, he pointed to his friend's neck. Deep in the loose, pale flesh just above the shirt collar, there was a ragged wound.
He has been polluted, and I think he has lost quite a bit of blood.
A curse on this day!
Tergut's face was anguished, and he pressed his friend's hand in his two big ones. Helen was the first to rally.
Let us think sensibly. This is perhaps only the first time he has been attacked. You didn't see any sign of this in him when we were here yesterday.
It was quite normal.
After a minute, Mr. Erozan stirred, groping at his neck as if it hurt. When his fingers found the little wound with its trickle of drying blood, he buried his face in his hands, sobbing, a heart-rending sound. Tirgut put an arm around his shoulders, and Mr. Erozan suddenly grasped Tirgut's arm and seemed to be imploring something of him in a flood of Turkish. For a moment, Tirgut was silent.
He told me that he understands he can be bitten only twice more by this devil before becoming one himself. He asks me, if this thing should come to pass, to kill him with my own hands.
Tirgut turned away, and I thought I saw a glistening of tears in his eyes. Selim Aksoy had been hovering behind us, and now he spoke to Tirgut again. Tirgut nodded.
Mr. Aksoy has reminded me of the work we have come here to do, and he is right. Other researchers will begin to arrive soon, and we must either lock the archive or open it to the public. He offers to desert his shop today and serve as librarian here. But first we must clean up these documents and see what damage has been done to them, and above all, we must find a safe place for my friend to rest. Also, Mr. Aksoy would like to show us something in the archives before other people are present.
Selim vanished, returning after a few minutes with a small book.
This is what Selim Aksoy wished to show us here this morning. It is a passage that Mr. Aksoy remembered from one of his researches here. The author is unknown, and it is an account of some events in the year 1477. Yes, my friends, the year after Vlad Dracula was killed in battle in Wallachia. Here it tells how in that year there were cases of the plague in Istanbul, a plague that caused the imams to bury some of the corpses with stakes through their hearts. Then it tells about the entrance into the city of a party of monks from the Carpathians. This is what made Mr. Aksoy remember the volume, in a wagon pulled by mules. The monks begged for asylum in a monastery in Istanbul, and resided there for 9 days and 9 nights. That is the whole account, and the connections within it are very unclear. It says nothing more about the monks or what became of them. It was this word, Carpathian, that my friend Selim wished us to know about here.
Selim Aksoy nodded emphatically, but I could not help sighing. The passage had a weird resonance. It gave me a feeling of unquiet without shedding any light on our problems. The year 1477. That was indeed strange, but it could have been a coincidence. Tirgut tapped his chin with a large finger.
Well, my friends, what do you think of this account Selim Aksoy has discovered?
It's interesting, but I can't see how it helps us find the tomb.
I can't see that either. However, I note a certain similarity here between this passage and the fragment of a letter I read to you this morning.
The disturbances in the tomb at Snagov, whatever they were, occurred in the same year, 1477. We know already that that is the year after Vlad Dracula died. And it was a group of monks who were so concerned about something at Snagov. Couldn't these have been the same monks or some group connected with Snagov?
Possibly, but that is conjecture. This account says only that the monks were from the Carpathians. The Carpathians must have been full of monasteries in that era. I thought Turgut looked disappointed, and he began to say something, but just then we were interrupted by a wheezing gasp. It was Mr. Erozan, still resting on Turgut's jacket on the floor.
He's fainted. Here we are, chatting like magpies.
Taking some garlic from his pocket, he held it to his friend's nose, and the man spluttered and revived a little.
Quick, we must take him home. Professor, madam, help me. We will call a taxicab and carry him to my apartment. My wife and I can care for him there. Selim will stay here with the archive. It must open in a few minutes.
The business of transporting Mr. Erozan and settling him in Tergut's oriental parlor, where he lay pale but composed on one of the long divans, took much of the morning. When we had made sure Mr. Erozan was resting comfortably, Tergut took me into his eerie study for a few minutes. "Do you think it's safe for you and your wife to house this man here?" I couldn't help asking it.
"I will arrange every precaution. I do not expect any further attack here, but if there is one, our American friend will face a formidable defense."
"I'm sorry. We seem to have brought you a lot of trouble, Professor, right down to importing this menace to your door." Tergut fell silent for a moment.
"My friend, how do you intend to find Professor Rossi?"
The blunt question went into me like a blade. I'm still trying to piece all this information together, but as far as our next move goes, I can only tell you that we are going to Budapest for a few days.
Budapest?
I could almost see the conjectures racing across his broad face. Yes, Helen feels strongly that her mother might have information for us that she's never drawn out of her, so we're going to talk with her mother in person.
When will you leave?
Perhaps tomorrow or the day after. We'll stay 5 or 6 days, I think, and then come back here.
Very well. And you must carry this with you.
Tergut stood up suddenly and took from a cabinet the little vampire hunting kit he had shown us the day before. He set it squarely in front of me. Helen was tired, and I reluctantly left her to nap at the pension. I didn't like her being alone there, but she pointed out that broad daylight was probably protection enough. We had several hours before Helen could call her aunt again, and there was nothing we could do to arrange our trip until we received her instructions. I put my briefcase into Helen's care and forced myself to go for a walk in Istanbul's lovely streets, feeling I would go stir-crazy if I stayed in my room pretending to read or trying to think.
When I was a girl, I lived in a tiny village in Transylvania, very close to the Argeș River. I had many brothers and sisters, most of whom still live in that region. My father always said that we were descended from old and noble families, but my ancestors had fallen on hard times, and I grew up without shoes or warm blankets. When I was about 18, an old woman came to our village, from a village higher up in the mountains above the river. She was a vraka, a healer, and one with special powers to look into the future. She told my father she had a present for him and his children, that she had heard about our family and wanted to give him something magical that was rightfully his. My father was an impatient man, with no time for superstitious old women, although he himself always rubbed all the openings of our cottage with garlic, the chimney and doorframe, the keyhole and the windows, to keep out vampires. He sent the old woman rudely away, saying he had no money to give her for whatever she was peddling. Later, when I went to the village well for water, I saw her standing there, and I gave her a drink and some bread. She blessed me, and told me I was kinder than my father, and that she would reward my generosity. Then she took from a bag at her waist a tiny coin, and she put it in my hand, telling me to hide it and keep it safe, because it belonged to our family. She said also that it came from a castle above the Argesh. I knew I should show the coin to my father, but I did not. Instead, I hid it under my corner of the bed I shared with my sisters, and I told no one about it. Sometimes I would get it out when I thought nobody was looking. I would hold it in my hand, and wonder what the old woman had meant by giving it to me. On one side of the coin was a strange creature with a looped tail, and on the other a bird and a tiny cross. A couple of years passed, and I continued to work my father's land and help my mother in the house. My father was in despair about having several daughters. He said we would never get married because he was too poor to give anything for a dowry, and that we would always be a trouble to him. But my mother told us that everyone in the village said we were so beautiful, someone would marry us anyway. This was my situation in life when I met Professor Rossi. It was unusual for strangers to come to our village, especially anyone from far away. But one day, everyone was passing around the news that a man from Bucharest had come to the tavern, and with him a man from another country. They were asking questions about the villages along the river, and about the ruined castle in the mountains upriver, a day's walk above our village. I was curious. I went out to get water so that I could hear more about it, and when I entered the village square, I saw the stranger sitting at one of the two tables outside our tavern, talking with an old man who was always there. One of the strangers was large and dark, like a gypsy, but in city clothes. The other wore a brown jacket in a style I had never seen before, and wide trousers tucked into walking boots, and a broad brown hat on his head. As I walked past, the foreign man glanced up, and I saw to my surprise that he was young and handsome, with a golden beard and bright blue eyes like the people in the German villages of our country. He touched his hat and looked quickly away, and the ugly man touched his hat too. And then they went back to talking with old Ivan and writing things down. I walked quickly on, not wanting the handsome stranger to think I was more forward than my friends. The next morning, it was said in the village that the strangers had given money to a young man in the tavern to show them the way up to the ruined castle called Poyenari, high above the Argesh. They would be gone overnight. I heard my father tell one of his friends that they were looking for the castle of Prince Vlad. He said that probably the stranger was looking for treasure, which was foolish, because all the treasure of the prince who had lived there was deeply buried and had a wicked spell on it. My father said if anyone found it, and if it were exorcised, he should have had some of it himself. Some of it belonged by rights to him. Then he saw me and my sisters listening, and he closed his mouth tightly. What my father had said reminded me of the little coin the old woman had given me, and I thought guiltily that I had something I should have given to my father. But a rebellion rose up inside me, and I decided to try to give my coin to the handsome stranger, since he was looking for treasure at the castle. When I had the chance, I took the coin from its hiding place and knotted it in the corner of a kerchief, which I tied to my apron. The stranger did not appear again for 2 days. I felt very sad, and I thought it would be impossible for me to give my coin to him. But luck was with me that evening. Just as I was leaving my father's field, where I had stayed to work while my brothers and sisters were doing other chores, I saw the stranger walking by himself at the edge of the woods. He was walking along the path to the river, walking with his head bent and his hands clasped behind him. He was completely alone, and now that I had the chance to speak with him, I felt frightened. To give myself courage, I grasped the knot in my kerchief where the coin was hidden. I walked toward him, and then stood in the path waiting for his approach. It seemed to take a long time while I stood there waiting. He must not have noticed me until we were almost face to face. Then he suddenly glanced up from the path, looking very surprised. He took off his hat and stepped aside, as if to let me pass him. But I stayed very still, gathering my courage, and said hello to him. He bowed a little and smiled, and we stood staring at each other for a moment. There was nothing in his face or manner to make me feel afraid, but I was almost overcome by shyness. Before I could lose all my courage, I unwrapped the coin. I handed it to him silently, and he took it from my hand and turned it over, looking at it with care. Suddenly, a light flashed over his face, and he glanced at me again, very sharply, as if he could look through my heart. He had the brightest, bluest eyes you can imagine. I felt a trembling all over.
De unde? From where?
He gestured to show me his question. I was surprised that he seemed to know a few words of our language. He tapped the ground and I understood. Had I gotten it out of the earth? I shook my head.
De unde?
I tried to show him an old woman, kerchief on her head, bending over her stick. I showed her handing me the coin. He nodded, frowned. He made the signs of the old woman, then pointed along the path toward our village.
From there?
No. I shook my head again and pointed upriver and into the sky to where I thought the castle was and the old woman's village. The light came into his face again, and he closed his hand on the coin. Then he handed it back to me. But I refused it, pointing to him and feeling myself turn red. He smiled for the first time and bowed to me, and I felt as if heaven had opened up to my eyes for a moment.
Mulțumesc. Thank you.
Then I wanted to hurry away before my father missed me at the supper table, but the stranger stopped me with a quick motion. He pointed to himself.
Manumesc Bartolomeo Rossi.
He repeated it, then wrote it for me in the earth at our feet. It made me laugh to try to pronounce it after him. Then he pointed at me.
Voi? What is your name?
I told him, and he repeated it, smiling again. He seemed to be groping for words.
Familia?
My family name is Getzi. Surprise seemed to fill his face. He pointed in the direction of the river, then at me, and said something again and again, followed by the word Dracula, which I understood to mean of the dragon. I could not gather his meaning. Finally he shook his head and sighed.
Tomorrow.
He pointed at me, at himself, at the spot where we stood, and at the sun in the sky. I understood that he was asking me to meet him there at the same time the next evening. All that evening, at my father's table, and washing and drying the dishes with my mother, I thought about the stranger. I thought about his foreign clothes, his polite bow, his expression that was absent-minded and alert at the same time, his beautifully bright eyes. I thought about him all the next day as I spun and wove with my sisters, made our dinner, drew water and worked in the fields. At evening, I stayed behind to finish my weeding alone, and I felt relieved when my brothers and father disappeared toward the village. As soon as they were gone, I hurried to the edge of the wood. The stranger was sitting there against a tree, and when he saw me, he jumped up and offered me a seat on a log near the path. But I was afraid someone from the village might pass by, and I led him deeper into the woods, my heart beating hard. There we sat on two rocks. The woods were full of the evening sounds of the birds. It was early summer, and very green and warm. The stranger took the coin I had given him out of his pocket and set it carefully on the ground. Then he pulled a couple of books from his knapsack and began to turn through them. Very slowly, looking often at his books, he asked me if I had seen any other coins like the one I had given him. I said I had not. He said the creature on the coin was a dragon, and he asked me if I had ever seen this dragon anywhere else, on a building or a book. I said I had one on my shoulder. At first he could not understand what I was saying at all.
Dracul?
He held up the coin. I touched the shoulder of my blouse and nodded. He looked at the ground, his face reddening. And suddenly I felt that I was the brave one. I opened my wool vest and took it off, then untied the neck of my blouse. My heart was pounding, but something had come over me and I could not stop myself. He looked away, but I pulled my blouse off my shoulder and pointed. I could not remember a time when I had not had a small, dark, green dragon imprinted on my skin there. My mother said it was put on one child in every generation of my father's family, and that he had chosen me because he thought I might grow up to be the ugliest. He said that his grandfather had told him this was necessary to keep evil spirits away from our family. The stranger looked carefully at the dragon on my skin. He asked me who had put the dragon there. When I said my father had done it, with the help of an old woman in the village, a healer, he asked if he could talk with my father about this. I shook my head so hard that he blushed deeply again. Then he told me, with great difficulty, that my family came from the line of an evil prince who had built a castle above the river. This prince had been called the Son of the Dragon, and he had killed many people. He said the prince had become a Prikulik, a vampire. I crossed myself and asked Mary for her protection. At last, I pointed to the sun, which had nearly set, to show him that I had to go home. And he stood up quickly, looking serious. Then he gave me his hand and helped me to my feet. When I grasped his hand, my heart leapt into my fingers. I was confused and I turned away quickly. But suddenly, I thought to myself that he was too much interested in evil spirits and might put himself in danger. Perhaps I could give him something that would protect him. I pointed to the ground and the sun. Come tomorrow. He hesitated for a moment, and finally he smiled. He put his hat on and touched the brim. Then he disappeared into the woods. The next morning I did a wicked thing. I opened my parents' wooden chest, and I took from it a little silver dagger I had seen there several times before. My mother had once said it was for killing vampires if they came to trouble the people or the herds. I also took a handful of garlic flowers from my mother's garden. I hid these items in my kerchief when I went to the fields. I was very nervous by the time I reached the stranger, whom I found deep in the woods on our ledge of rocks. He was smoking his pipe, but when I came toward him, he put it down and jumped to his feet. I sat down with him and showed him what I had brought. He looked startled when he saw the knife, and very interested when I explained to him that he could use it to kill Prikuliki. He wanted to refuse it, but I begged him so earnestly to take it that he stopped smiling and put it thoughtfully into his knapsack, wrapping it first in my kerchief. Then I gave him the garlic flowers and showed him that he should keep some in his jacket pocket. I asked him how long he would be staying in our village, and he showed me 5 fingers. 5 more days. He made me understand that he would travel to several villages nearby, walking to each from our village to talk with people about the castle. I asked him where he would go when he left our village at the end of 5 days. He said that he was going to a country called Greece, which I had heard of before, and then back to his own village in his own country. Suddenly, I understood that he would leave soon, and that I would never see him again, or anyone like him, and my eyes filled with tears. I had not meant to cry. I never cried over the annoying young men in the village, but my tears would not obey me, and they ran down my cheeks. He looked very distressed, and pulled a white handkerchief out of his jacket pocket and gave it to me. What was the problem? I shook my head. He rose slowly and gave me his hand to help me up, as he had the night before. While I was getting up, I stumbled and fell against him without meaning to. And when he caught me, we kissed each other. Then I turned and ran through the woods. At the path, I looked back. He was standing there, still as a tree, looking after me. I ran all the way to the village and lay awake during the night with his handkerchief hidden in my hand. The next evening he was there in the same place, as if he had never moved from the spot where I had left him. I ran to him, and he opened his arms to me and caught me. When we could not kiss each other any more, he spread his jacket on the ground, and we lay down together. In that hour, I learned about love, one moment at a time. After that, there were 3 nights until he left. We met earlier each evening. I told my mother and father any excuse I could think of, and I always came home with herbs from the woods as if I had gone there to gather them. Every night Bartolomeo told me he loved me and begged me to come with him when he left the village. Every night I asked him why he couldn't stay with me in the village. On the last night before he left, I began to cry as soon as we touched each other. He held me and kissed my hair. I had never met any man so gentle and kind. When I had stopped crying, he drew from his finger a little silver ring with a seal on it. I don't know for certain, but I think now it was the seal of his university. He wore it on the smallest finger of his left hand. He took it off and put it on my ring finger. Then he asked me to marry him. He must have been studying his dictionary, because I understood him right away. At first it seemed so impossible an idea that I simply began to cry again. I was very young. But then I agreed. He made me understand that he would return for me in 4 weeks. He would go to Greece to take care of something there, what I could not understand. Then he would come back for me and would give my father some money to make him happy. I tried to explain that I had no dowry, but he would not listen. Smiling, he showed me the dagger and coin I had given him, and then made a circle of his hands around my face and kissed me. I should have felt happy, but I had a sense that evil spirits were present, and I was afraid something might happen to keep him from returning. Every moment we spent together that evening was very sweet, because I thought each was the last. He was so confident, so sure that we would see each other again soon. The next morning, I heard that Bartolomeo had left the village, traveling with a farmer in his cart toward Tergoviste. The day was very long and sad for me, and in the evening I went to our meeting place in the woods to be alone there. Seeing it made me weep again. I sat on our rocks and finally lay down where we had lain every evening. I put my face against the earth and sobbed. Then I felt my hand brush against something among the ferns, and to my surprise I found there a package of letters in envelopes. I could not read the handwriting on them, where they were addressed to someone, but on the flap of each, his beautiful name was printed, as in a book. I realized the letters must have fallen out of his knapsack when he had opened it to show me he had the dagger and coin I'd given him. I thought of trying to mail them to him, but I could not think of any way to send them unnoticed. Also, I didn't know how I could pay to send something. I decided to save the letters to give him when he returned for me. 4 weeks passed very, very slowly. I made notches on the tree near our secret place so that I could keep track of the days. I worked in the field, helped my mother, spun and wove for our next winter's clothing, went to church, and listened wherever I could for news of Bartolomeo. I wondered constantly what would happen when he came back. Would he walk up to my father's door, knock on it and ask my father for my hand in marriage? I imagined how surprised my family would be. They would all gather at the door and stare while Bartolomeo gave them gifts and I kissed them goodbye. I passed 4 weeks in this way, and by the end of the 4th week, I was tired and could not eat or sleep very much. When I had cut almost 4 weeks of notches in my tree, I began to wait and watch for a sign of his return. After the 5th week, I felt ill, and I was certain that the prince of the Prikuliki had killed him. Once I even had the thought that my beloved might return to me in the form of a vampire himself. In the 6th and 7th week I began to give up hope. In the 8th week, I knew suddenly by many signs I had heard about among the married women that I would have a child. Then I cried silently in my sister's bed at night, and I felt the whole world, even God and the Holy Mother, had forgotten about me. I did not know what had happened to Bartolomeo, but I believed it must have been something terrible, because I knew he had truly loved me. I wrote to my sister Eva, and she helped me to escape to Hungary. I waited to write to Bartolomeo until after the baby was born, because I wanted to tell him about a real baby, not to tell him only about my pregnancy. When Elena was 1 month old, I asked my brother-in-law to help me find an address for Bartolomeo's university, Oxford, and I wrote the strange words myself on the envelope. My brother-in-law penned the letter for me in German, and I signed it with my own hand. When Elena was already taking her first steps, a letter came from Bartolomeo. It was from America, not from England, and it was written in German. My brother-in-law translated it for me in a very gentle voice, but I saw that he was too honest to change anything it said. In his letter, Bartolomeo told me politely that he had never heard of me or seen my name before, and that he had never been to Romania, so that the child I described could not be his. He was sorry to hear such a sad story, and he wished me better fortunes. It was a short letter, and very kind, not harsh, and in it there was no sign that he knew me. I cried for a long time. I was young, and I did not understand that people can change, that their minds and feelings can change. When I had been in Hungary for several years, I began to understand that you can be one person at home and a different person when you are in a different country. I realized that something like this had happened to Bartolomeo. In the end, my only wish was that he had not lied, had not said he didn't know me at all. I wished that, because I had felt when we were together that he was an honorable person, a truthful person, and I did not want to think badly of him.
When her mother had finished speaking, Helen looked as stunned as I felt. Throughout the story she had sat quiet, translating as if barely breathing. At first we sat in silence at the table, the three of us, but after a moment Helen turned to me, gesturing helplessly toward the package of letters that lay before us on the table. I understood. I'd been thinking the same thing. Why didn't she send some of these to Rossi to prove he had been with her in Romania? Her mother's answer, when she translated it for me, brought a lump to my throat, a pain that was partly for her and partly for my perfidious mentor.
I thought about doing that, but from his letter I understood that he had changed his mind completely. I decided it would make no difference for me to send him these letters, except to bring me more pain, and then I would have lost some of the few pieces of him that I could keep. Then why didn't she at least give these letters to me long ago?
Helen was defiant. Her question was fierce, and she turned it on her mother the next second. The older woman shook her head. Helen's face hardened.
She says that she knew I hated my father, and she was waiting for someone who loved him.
As soon as we were settled in the bus, I got out Rossi's letters, which Helen's mother had entrusted to us, and carefully opened the first one. In recording it here, I will honor Rossi's desire to protect his friend's privacy with a nom de plume. A nom de guerre, he'd called it. It was very strange to see Rossi's handwriting again, that same younger, less cramped version of it, on the yellowing pages.
June 20th, 1930. My dear friend, I haven't a soul in the world to talk to at this moment, and I find myself with pen in hand wishing for your company in particular. You would be full of your usual mild amazement at the scene I'm enjoying just now. I've been in a state of disbelief myself today, as you would be if you could see where I am, on a train that's puffing towards Bucharest. I hadn't planned to come here, but something quite remarkable has brought me. I was in Istanbul until a few days ago, on a bit of research I've been keeping under my hat, and I found something there that made me want to come here. Not want to, actually. It would be more accurate to say I'm terrified to, and yet feel compelled. We're slowing for a town with a chance to buy breakfast. I'll desist for the moment, and come back to this later. Afternoon, Bucharest. I'm down for what would be a siesta if my mind weren't in such a state of unrest and excitement. It's accursedly hot here. I thought this would be a land of cool mountains, but if it is, I haven't reached any yet. I'm half inclined not to set down here what I'm about, but you'll be so very perplexed by my ravings if I don't that I think I must. To make it short and shocking, I'm on a quest of sorts, an historian's hunt for Dracula. Not Count Dracula of the Romantic stage, but a real Dracula. Dracula. Vlad III, a 15th century tyrant who lived in Transylvania and Wallachia. I stopped in Istanbul the better part of a week to see an archive there that contains some documents about him collected by the Turks, and while there, I found a most remarkable set of maps that I believe to be clues to the whereabouts of his tomb. I'll explain to you at greater length when I'm home what sent me on this chase, and I simply have to beg your indulgence in the meantime. In any case, my stay in Istanbul turned dark at the end, and has rather frightened me, although that will surely sound foolish at a distance. But I'm not easily put off a quest once I've begun, as you know, and I couldn't help coming here with copies I've made of those maps, to look for more information about Dracula's tomb. I should explain to you, at the very least, that he is supposed to have been buried in an island monastery in Lake Snagov, in western Romania. The maps I found in Istanbul, with his tomb clearly marked on them, show no island, no lake, and nothing that looks like Western Romania, as far as I can tell. It always seems to me a good idea to check the obvious first, since the obvious is sometimes the right answer. I've resolved, therefore, to make my way to Lake Snagov with the maps and ascertain for myself that the tomb is not there. Your devoted friend, Bartholomew Rossi. June 22nd, Lake Snagov. My dear friend, I haven't yet seen any place to post my first letter. To post it with the confidence, that is, that it will ever reach your hands, but I'll go hopefully on here despite that, since a great deal has happened. Yesterday, I found a young professor of archaeology at the university who was kind enough to inform me that one of his colleagues, a Mr. Georgescu, has made a speciality of the history of Snagov and is digging out there this summer. Of course, I was tremendously excited to learn this and have decided to put myself, maps and bags and all, into the hands of a driver who can take me out there today. Evening. My dear friend, I can't help continuing this spurious correspondence of ours. May it unfold itself under your eyes eventually, because it's been such a remarkable day that I simply must talk with someone. I left Bucharest this afternoon in a neat little taxicab to reach Lake Snagov. My first intimation of the place was the driver's waving an excited hand, on which I looked out and saw a lake. It is an exceptionally lovely place, my friend, bucolic and otherworldly. Imagine, if you will, a sparkling long water, which you catch glimpses of from the road between dense groves of trees. Nestled here and there in the woods are fine villas. When you get to an opening in the forest, you look out across the lake to the island where the monastery lies.
The island is a short boat ride from shore, and is wooded like the banks of the lake. Above its trees rise the splendid Byzantine cupolas of the monastery church, and across the water comes the sound of bells, struck by a monk's wooden mallet. I could have stood looking and listening far longer without growing restless, but my determination to find the archaeologist before nightfall sent me into the restaurant. I used a little sign language and my best pidgin Latin to get us a boat to the island. The monastery was even lovelier up close, and rather forbidding with its ancient walls and high cupolas, each crowned with an ornate seven-pointed cross. The boatman led us up steep steps to it, and I would have entered the great wooden doors at once, but the fellow pointed us around the back. Behind the church, in the midst of a large ruin, we did indeed find a man with a shovel. He was a hearty-looking middle-aged man, deeply tanned and with curly black hair. Two boys worked beside him, turning carefully through the soil by hand, and from time to time he set down his shovel and did the same. Only when our boatman shouted a greeting did they all look up. I held out my hand and, before lapsing into English, tried one of my few Romanian phrases. Ma numesc Bartolomeo Rossi. The archaeologist burst into laughter as he gripped my hand. Up close he was a sturdy, tanned fellow with a network of lines around his eyes and mouth.
Ma nume Shvelior Georgescu. How do you do? How can I help you?
For a moment I was transported to our walking trip last year. He might have been any one of those weather-beaten Highlanders of whom we were constantly asking directions, only with dark hair instead of sandy. I puzzled stupidly. You speak English?
A wee bit. It has been a long time since I have had the chance to practice, but it will come back to my tongue yet.
I beg your pardon. I understand you have a special interest in Vlad the Third, and I would very much like to talk to you. I'm an historian from Oxford University. He nodded.
Have you come so far just to see his grave?
Well, I had hoped. Mr. Georgescu clapped me on the shoulder, not unkindly.
Ah, you hoped, you hoped. But I shall have to bring down your hopes a bit, my lad. Come, I'll take you for the walking tour.
Leaning his shovel against a half-excavated wall, he beckoned to me. I let the driver and boatman know I was taken care of, and crossed the boatman's palm with silver. He touched his hat and disappeared, and the driver sat down against the ruin and took out a pocket flask. Mr. Georgescu waved a broad hand about him.
Very good. We will go around the outside first. You know the history of this island? A little? There was a church here in the 14th century, and the monastery was built a wee bit later, also in that century. Dracula came to power in Wallachia for the second time in 1462. I believe he liked this monastery, because an island is easy to protect.
The man's English was so fascinating that I was finding it hard to concentrate on what he said, but his last point had sunk in. It took only a glance around to picture even a few monks defending this stronghold from invaders.
Vlad made a fortress of the existing monastery. He built fortified walls around it and a prison and torture chamber. This, where we are digging now, was the prison. We have found several skeletons in it already.
He smiled broadly, and his gold teeth gleamed in the sun. And this is Vlad's church, then? I pointed at the lovely building nearby, with its soaring cupolas and the dark trees rustling around its walls.
No, I'm afraid not. The monastery was partly burned by the Turks in 1462, when Vlad's brother, Radu, an Ottoman puppet, was on the throne of Wallachia. Just after Vlad was buried here, a terrible storm blew his church into the lake.
Was Vlad buried here? I longed to ask it, but I kept my mouth firmly closed.
The peasants must have thought it was God's punishment for his sins. The church was rebuilt in 1517. Took 3 years, and you see here the results. The outside walls in the monastery are a restoration, only about 30 years old. Now, let us go into the church.
We went around to the front doors, great carved wooden ones, and there I entered a world I had never known before. Quite a different one from our Anglican chapels. It was cold inside, and before I could see anything in the penetrating darkness of the interior, I could smell a smoky spice on the air and feel a clammy draught from the stones, as if they were breathing. When my eyes adjusted to the gloom, it was only to catch faint gleams of brass and candle flame. The daylight filtered in dimly through heavy, dark-coloured glass.